Welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about research design and the use of appropriate control groups for practice-based research studies. And we've all seen the research where a pharmacist or a group of pharmacists get involved in patient care, and the outcomes are then compared to a usual care group, a group of patients who did not have the benefit of the pharmacist's expertise. Sometimes these analyses are either a retrospective cohort analysis where the pharmacist care group is compared to a historical control, or the analysis might be a prospective cohort where two groups treated during the same time frame are compared. And as we all know, these kinds of studies are prone to bias because the groups are often different in some important ways. Only through a randomized control trial can we truly control all of the variables. But is that all that is required, simply randomizing patients into a pharmacist care group versus a usual care group? Well, the answer is no. We also need to control for another variable. And here to tell us all about this additional variable are Dr. Elizabeth Cook and Dr. Rachel Sharpton from the Ben and Mady Fish College of Pharmacy at the University of Texas at Tyler. Dr. Cook practices at Bethesda Health Clinic, a free clinic for the underserved in Tyler, Texas, and Dr. Sharpton practices at UT Health, East Texas North Campus, Family Medicine Clinic, also in Tyler. Well, Lizzie, Rachel, it's great to have you on the iFormRx podcast.
Thank you for having us, Stuart.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, before we get started, I want you to imagine you're perusing the latest issue of the Journal of the American College of Clinical Pharmacy when the title of one of the articles catches your eye. It's Improved Health Outcomes with Comprehensive Medication Management Provided by Pharmacists, a Randomized Control Trial. You quickly glance through the abstract, and the results are pretty darn impressive. The study was conducted at 10 indigent care clinics in Texas. Over 700 patients were enrolled in the study, and the group that received comprehensive medication management from the pharmacists were 31% more likely to achieve their therapeutic goals, including such measures as blood pressure, A1C, and pain control, but they were also 15% less likely to be hospitalized or die over the two-year study. On the surface, this study seems great. It's randomized and it's controlled. The composite outcome measure, hospitalizations and all-cause mortality, are clinically relevant, and the authors don't rely on strictly surrogate measures like blood pressure to demonstrate the value of this intervention. But before we talk about your commentary and the research study that you analyzed for iFormRx, Rachel and Lizzie, I'm wondering what's going through your mind when you read a study like this. What additional information would you like to know about this study, its design, and analytical methods?
Well, when examining a study like this, there's some things that are very important. So, for example, you want a very clear description of that pharmacist care group as well as the usual care that is provided. So, for example, as ambulatory care pharmacists, we have multiple different types of practice sites and multiple different types of care models that in which patient care is provided. And so what was the scope of practice that that pharmacist was using? Additionally, it's very important to know, what is that usual care group? Usual care can kind of be an ambiguous term. What is the usual care that they were providing in that particular study is going to be very important. In addition, things like randomization. So, for example, at the patient level, that's going to be important. For example, this is a Texas study, but Texas is a big state. Was it East Texas, West Texas? That could be different. Were they stratified by their location, their practice level, and their provider level? Another thing to consider as well, is it externally valid? So sometimes we idealize in our intervention groups, and the practice models are just not able to be implemented in everyday practice because they are too complicated.
To kind of tie in all of those to the study that we actually analyzed in the iFormRx article, looking at the attention the patients were given. So was attention addressed in this study design? So for example, how often were the patients visited? We can liken attention to placebo pills that are used in randomized placebo-controlled trials. So for example, were the patients given the same dose of attention? Were they seen for the same amount of time? Additionally, did frequency come into play? Were the patients seen at the same intervals of time between visits? Also, did each group actually utilize the services offered to them? Some patients may default from appointments frequently. These are all things that need to be considered and are far too often overlooked.
So, Lizzie, in the commentary you wrote for iFormerX entitled, "Are You Really Paying Attention? The Importance of Attention Controls," you critically examined the Real Diabetes Study, which was published in Diabetes Care in April 2018. Now, for those in our audience who haven't read that paper, can you give us a brief summary of the study methods and its results?
So the Real Diabetes Trial was designed to assess the efficacy of manual occupational therapy interventions on the improvement of glycemic control and the psychosocial well-being of an ethnically diverse group of young adults with low socioeconomic status and either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. The intervention group received individualized assessments and goal-setting plans, whereas the attention control group, or our placebo group in this study, received standardized diabetes education materials from government websites, and they attempted to control for the attention factors mentioned earlier by having those patients followed up with an occupational therapist via phone call, whereas those with the individualized assessments and goal-setting heard from the occupational therapist via home visits at the patient's convenience. In terms of the results of the study, the intervention group actually had a decrease in A1C by about 0.5%. In the control group, those groups that were followed up by the occupational therapist via phone call, had about a 0.3% increase in their A1Cs.
So tell us a little bit about what you believe to be the key strengths and limitations of this study. Are there major sources of bias, confounders, or other threats to the internal validity?
Well, Stuart, one of the biggest strengths of these studies is that they are actually attempting to control for the effects of attention. So in a lot of studies previously have looked at ambulatory care pharmacists making an intervention, but they haven't accounted for that attention piece. And that is really what these studies are trying to do, is they're trying to capture that attention component in order to see if the intervention is truly having an effect.
The flip side of trying to control for attention is that it's really impossible to define all of the components of attention. And that's a possible limiting factor. And it may even place some of those participants at a disadvantage. For example, there was a study that was done in women and men who had recently had children. It was a parenting class. And the way that they organized it, they allowed the patients to attend a group session, and the patients talked amongst themselves in order to come up with the best parenting tips. Sometimes those parents were not able to come up with good parenting tips and turned to the leader of the group to offer them advice. However, protocol stated that they were not allowed to give any form of advice to the patients participating in that particular study. This could be an unethical component of conducting one of these attention placebo control trials. Additionally, you need to take into account the patient's personal connection with a provider, and that could actually impact their receptiveness to implementing certain behavioral changes.
So based on the methods employed in this study and its results, do you think there is sufficient proof that occupational therapists, rather than attention per se, make a real difference in the care of patients with diabetes? And there have been lots of studies published with pharmacists providing care to patients with diabetes. The data suggests that when pharmacists get involved, glycemic control improves. But are those studies sufficiently rigorous in your mind? Can we claim that pharmacists are any better than usual care or occupational therapists, for that matter, in caring for patients with diabetes?
You know, looking at this trial, it's really hard to say, given that there were so many different ways that the attention factors differed. In terms of modality, the intervention group had in-person communication, whereas the control group had more of a telephonic form of communication. Sometimes, again, like we mentioned, with the patient's personal connection with the provider, that can create sort of a disconnect compared to an in-person visit. Additionally, this trial had differences in the dose of the intervention or the time of contact with the patient. So for the intervention group, there was a prescribed number of hours that the occupational therapist had to contact the patient and visit with them, whereas in the control group, there was no set amount of contact hours. Again, along with our dose comes our frequency. The intervention group was allowed to be contacted by the occupational therapist at the convenience of the patient, whereas the control group who received the phone calls had scheduled phone calls, and these were not necessarily scheduled at the patient's convenience, like the in-person visits.
And also, when you think about the studies that have been examining pharmacists that are providing care, traditionally, they have not included this attention control, and that does throw some question into the data. So what's really important is that moving forward, we take this into account as we design our prospective trial. And to prove that attention alone is not what's making us an important variable in the healthcare team equation.
Well, Lizzie and Rachel, I want to thank you both for being here on the iPharmaRx podcast and discussing research design and the importance of attention controls when conducting practice-based research. I think it's clear from your comments that this is a variable that we should be considering when we read papers, and also a variable we should be considering when designing studies. Well, tell us what you think. We would love to hear from you about what you consider to be the most important variables to control for in terms of attention. Only iPharmaRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iPharmaRx. It's free. Sign up today and be sure to sign in every time you visit. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iPharmaRx, signing off.